You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to my dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Yeah, that's a little bit too happy music for today. Joining me is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how you doing?
Good, Mac. How are you?
I'm obviously a shitty day for the Marine Corps, but I'm all right. Yeah. I'm all right. I wanted to have you on because you've both trained Marines that have gone on Marine Expeditionary Units. You've been in OPSO, so wanted to have you on to do a little explaining. So I appreciate you taking time this morning and talking.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Okay. The first of all, I want to ask you to explain a couple of terms that General Osterman used in the press conference. Explain to everybody what the concept of the Amphibious Ready Group, MEW, is. And tell everybody what these guys are.
Right. This is a Marine Air Ground Task Force of a little between 2,000 and 2,300 or so Marines and sailors who go out and they basically are on watch in different parts of the world in areas of trouble, and they do do emergency missions as required for the Marine Corps. In addition, when there is a no kidding conflict or an emergency that's already been declared, they will go in and according to their capabilities, which are considerable, they'll go ahead and participate. And so the biggest part of the MAGTAF, or Marine Air Ground Task Force, that we call a MEU, Marine Expeditionary Unit, is the battalion landing team. They're the ground combat element. It's built around an infantry battalion. It's reinforced with an AAV platoon of usually between 12 and 14 or so amphibious assault vehicles. It has a tank platoon. It has an engineer platoon, combat engineer platoon. It has an artillery battery added to it, and so it's pretty capable. And what we're talking about in this instance is the assault amphibian platoon, which is usually married up, matter of fact, always married up with a rifle company, and they develop a habitual relationship. They're on the same ship, and they do operations together. You can put a Marine rifle company that's actually reinforced with four artillery observer and air controllers and so forth, and a squad of engineers. You put them on 12 or so amphibious assault vehicles, and the whole company can go ashore. A very capable force, because each AAV is armed with a 50 caliber machine gun and a Mark 19 that the crew chief, who's on the right side of the track as you're entering it, behind these guns, he is an actual AAV crewman, as is the driver. Everyone else pretty much in the thing is an infantryman.
Okay, let me we'll go into that here in a minute. Let me ask you to explain something else. General Osterman talked about, you know, the Marine Corps procured the majority of the AAV fleet in the 1970s, and they've undergone multiple what's called service life extension plans. Can you explain SLEP to everybody and the process of what they do to these vehicles as they take them back?
Yeah, what they'll do is they'll put new engines in them sometimes. They'll rework the mechanical system that allows them to actually be ocean-going vessels. They'll refurbish the guns. They'll make sure that the electrical systems that operate the turret, you know, are upgraded to the most degree they can. The original vehicle, I think, came out in 1971, and we've been upgrading them ever since. It used to be that they just had one machine gun on board, and in 1987 or 88, we switched from that one machine gun, which was the same machine gun that was on a tank, an M60 tank, M85, 50 cal. They switched over to what they have to this day, which is the UpGun system, which is a Mod Deuce on the left side of the turret and a Mark 19 on the right side, or vice versa. I may have forgot which one goes where. But it's two guns basically operated by the crew chief. And periodically they'll do the SLEP thing to where they'll upgrade them so that they're as safe as possible and as effective as possible.
Right. And the SLEP thing is they take this thing down to the metal. I mean, so it's not just like they come in and they change the oil. That is not what SLEP is. SLEP is you essentially get a new vehicle. I mean, they test the integrity of the metal. Once they strip it down to its metal, I mean, when you see this thing, it's like nothing. And then they rebuild it. So it's not just a tune-up. Let me ask you, first question, how often does the Marine Corps have an event like this? I mean, you and I were talking earlier. I seem to remember an incident off the coast of Okinawa, but I can't even remember how recent that was. You said I recall one in the Med. These are pretty rare events. Hold on, I can't hear you. Hey, Jeff, hold on. I can't hear you. No. Something happened. All right, let me call you right back. Jeff Kenney, my guest, and Jeff Kenney's.
Can you hear me now, Mac?
Oh my God! Like you're like right next to me. So perfect. Okay.
Okay.
So let's talk about the history. Yeah, let's talk about the history of these kind of incidents, rare to say the least.
Right. I mean, the whole time I was in the Marine Corps from 1975 to when I retired in 2017. I only remember three, and I have to tell you, there was one, actually four. There was one that happened in the boat basin
right.
In Del Mar at Camp Pendleton.
Hold on, I just lost you. Hold on, I just lost you again.
Oh, geez.
I don't know what happened.
Okay, let me try something.
Now, you're better now.
How about now?
That's perfect.
Okay, the speaker keeps going off. I have to keep turning it back on.
Okay.
But that was like a test case, you know, where they were doing it. So my point is, with that one in the boat basin, they really work these vehicles a lot to make sure they're safe. And I never experienced, and I had a lot of AV infantry experience. I never had this happen.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I remember the boat basin one because it was in Del Mar at Camp Pendleton, right on the coast, and it was they were testing the vehicle, and they did nothing by the book. So it wasn't a question of, you know, somehow the vehicle malfunctioned. It was absolutely human negligence by the guy that was in charge of it. So I remember that one vividly.
Yeah. But the whole thing about switching from swimming to driving on ground is where it's most it seems like the few instances that that happen, that's where I've seen them happen.
Okay. All right, let me ask you this. Can you explain to everybody what were these guys, what were they doing? I mean, so they're off the coast of California. And a good friend of ours is a commanding officer, Chris Bronzi. So they're explain to everybody what they're doing, and explain how the ground combat element gets divided up into MEW, and what they're doing.
Okay, well, the MEW goes out on three ships, the big deck, which is like an LSD, a huge ship that's like a mini aircraft carrier, carries all the helicopter assets. And most of the GCE, as a matter of fact, most of the people on the MEW are on the big deck. Then there's two smaller ships. In this case, they're LPDs, where they do the rest of the MEW is on there. What they'll do is they'll put a rifle company and parts of the BLT on each of those smaller ships. And one of those rifle companies is the MEC company, we call it. And the MEC company are the guys who are married up with the Assault Amphibious Vehicle Platoon. And they operate together habitually. So what these guys were doing here early on, this is like their first time probably they're at sea together with the Navy. And what they do is they work out coordination between the ship and the Marines to basically get to the shore, do a mission, and then get back on the ship. And they do that repeatedly. In the case of the amphibious assault vehicles, they'll offload these guys about 6 kilometers or so from the beach. They'll come in, they'll hit the beach, they'll move to their objective, whatever it is, whether it's a raid or they're going to do a non-combatant evacuation operation or something like that. They'll do the mission, they'll come back, and they'll re-embark. And if you can do those three things, pretty much you can do anything in regards to amphibious operations you're going to face on the actual deployment. So here they were doing an operation. I'm not sure whether it was a raid. It probably was a raid because that's what they mostly do. And then the idea was to do the raid with the AAVs and then come back and re-embark on the ship. It seems like one of the AAVs, at least one, had difficulty. And so they left that guy on the beach with another AAV as kind of like a watch vehicle. And the other guys went and did the mission.
Got it. Got it. So
when they're getting back, trying to get back to the ship that then this tragedy happened.
Got it. All right. Next thing is you were the opso of Amu, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Could you explain, one, are these vehicles coming and going from the ship to shore by themselves? Is it a unit formation? And what is the criteria that you as the OPSO employ on whether these things can even get in the water or not relative to sea state and wind and things like that?
Right. And that's a key thing as far as the practice and the coordination between the Marines and the sailors on board these three ships. And what happens is because it's a surface vehicle, the sea state at the time is crucial to whether or not it's safe to put these vehicles off. If the sea state is above 3, which is like 3 feet of surf, 3 feet of sea state waves and stuff, then you won't do the mission. It's not safe enough. And the person who makes that decision is the commanding officer of the ship that emanates the AAVs. In other words, in this case, it would be one of the LPDs that sends it off. That guy decides. Apparently, the sea state was pretty low that allowed these guys to go off. I haven't heard that, you know, the sea state was heavy, but I know the Navy is highly, concerned about having accidents regarding surface ships. And matter of fact, regarding helicopters and aircraft also. The whole thing is dangerous to do this, even in the best of times, because you're talking about a lot of machinery moving, getting in and out of the water, confusion, a lot of spray and stuff like that, even if the sea state is calm. So I know this, that they wouldn't have put those amphibious assault vehicles out if the sea state was rough.
Got it. You just mentioned that, so you as the OPSO, you're evaluating that all the time. The MU commander also has a vote in that, right? He can say, before the ship commander, he can say, yeah, I don't like this, we're not going, right?
Absolutely. Usually, right. Though, the final arbiter,
right, the
is
final
that
guy.
Captain of that ship who puts it off, right. Who puts the ships off, the AAVs off.
Got it. So even if the MU commander says, yeah, I'm good with this, if the captain of that ship says I'm not, then they don't go.
Right.
Got it.
Because that ship, in order for it to put off those amphibious assault vehicles, he has to take in water. He has to, what they call, ballast down in order to, so the ship kind of gets lower in the water because they bring in seawater into the ship. And that allows the AAVs to swim off the safely swim off the vehicle, the ship, so they can get in formation. They'll get in a movement formation and then head towards the shore.
Got it. Got it. You talked a little bit about the Amtrak as a surface vehicle. Could you explain that? Because people have seen pictures of them moving through the water, and it looks like it's, you know, there's nothing sticking out of it, which is a source of, you know, which is really why it got invented, so that you could, even in a contested environment, that you could get guys to the beach without exposing them. So when you say it's a surface vehicle, can you explain what that means?
Yeah, it's we've had these things since World War II, and this was the latest model that was made in the early 70s. And just as you said, the idea is that they swim with a low profile above the surface of the water to avoid being hit from shore, gunfire. And so they'll swim. And then once they hit the beach, they transition to a land vehicle, and they're pretty capable. They can go about 50 or so plus miles an hour when they're moving fast. And they can carry, at the most, 25 Marines who don't have a lot of gear. Usually they carry about between 15 to 20 at the most. And then on this particular IV, I think they had 16 guys. That's about right. Because also, you bring all your stuff. The good thing about one of these things, it's you can carry water inside. You carry extra ammunition, food. You know, you can carry engineering stuff like barbed wire. You can attach stuff to the outside of the AAV and do it that way. So it's a very versatile vehicle, either both in the water and on land. And the thing about it is, in the water, like if you're in getting close to the shore or you're crossing a river or something, it makes virtually no noise. When it's on land, it sounds like a screaming elephant. It makes a lot of noise when it's moving. But, you know, it is a very highly versatile, you know, vehicle.
Just to illustrate your point, if you see pictures of it, people will say, oh, that, because you will have seen it extensively during the march up and during combat operations, more in Iraq than Afghanistan. When you see it, you'll say, oh, I got it. And honestly, the thing's a behemoth when you stand next to it. I mean, these things are gigantic.
Right.
And they're gigantic vehicles. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Something else, Mac. In 1990, they developed this stuff called ink armor, which was like a stuff we first, I think we got it for LAVs, and the idea was that you bolt this stuff on, and it would help protect from heavy small arms fire, up to 50 cal, like up to 12.7 Warsaw Pact type ammo. And then it changed from an ink armor to enhanced armor. It's this beveled looking thing, and that's what you see now when you see AAVs. And what's noticeable about that is it adds another 10 tons or so to the weight of the vehicle.
And increases the survivability. And I want to say it's also right good against ATGMs, right? They're shape charges, so there's it was designed to detonate them, and the gas that gets shot in would be shot into the vehicle is now shot against the skin of the vehicle because it essentially has a second skin.
So like SAGRs and RPGs and shit like that.
That
was the idea, and they have that now, and you know, that's another way adder to this thing.
Okay.
It's a great vehicle. You know, it's not the best fighting vehicle there is, but it is better than most other countries have.
Got it.
And you can rig the thing for medevac. You know, where you can put people in there and they're pretty comfortable on racks there's a system you can put in there that will allow you to carry like 6 to 9 casualties to where they can actually be taken care of.
Right, right.
And so it's like, you know, it has a lot of versatility.
Yeah, there's a communication variant for it, there's a recovery variant for it. So there's a whole family of these things that we use as, again, and they're not a small deal when it comes to power projection, you know, that the country uses around the world. I mean, it's one of the things, and again, it's one of the things that the Chinese are at breakneck speed attempting to develop so they can get into the business of power projection.
Yeah, the most modern place where it was where it really was shockingly obvious how versatile, how effective they were was when we invaded Grenada. You know, Grenada was basically dropping a lot of lighted infantry onto the island, both army and they used. It was a precursor to the MEU. It was basically the same organization. It was called the Marine Amphibious Unit, a MAU, and these guys were on their way to Beirut, and this Grenada went down, and the I think it was General Schwarzkopf, whatever his ability is. How is it that you got like so many troops stuck on the airfield in Grenada, but the Marines, one company of Marines is running roughshod over the whole island, seizing, you know, a sizable amount of the objectives that they had there because of the AAVs, the versatility.
Right. The Now, what I want everybody to do is if you have a piece of paper handy, or you could just imagine one, draw a rectangle on that piece of paper, and at the top end, in the top one third of it, draw on the left, upper left corner, draw a zero. Directly across from that to the right, draw an X, and then draw another zero in the top third, and then just below the top zero, and then below the X, draw another zero, and then draw a line behind that. And that upper third, Jeff and I will kind of walk through the construction of the vehicle. So all those zeros are the front left-hand corner is the driver. Behind him is the vehicle commander, and then to his right, that other zero is the gunner, and then forward where the X is, that's the engine compartment. So that's kind of how those guys stack up, and then the back two thirds of it are those are the true. That's where the embarked Marines will go. Now, Jeff, could you describe? Could you describe the back of that vehicle? How the what's back there?
Yeah, exactly. The guy behind the driver is the infantry unit commander. He's in charge of all the grunts in it, and behind him are the infantry embarked people, and usually it's a reinforced squad. So what we would usually do is have a squad of Marines, like hopefully 13 guys, and then a three-man machine gun team or a three-man mortar squad or two assault men, or something else that you might need. You might put in there, other folks like a team of engineers or whatever. And those guys would, although usually we put our squad engineers in their own AAV, and those guys, as soon as able – in an experienced unit, they would open. There's two hatches on top that run the length pretty much of the compartment that they're in above their heads. And so they can open those. You can secure those hatches, which are heavy in themselves, to the side of the AV so they'll stay open. And the Marines can observe. They can actually have situational awareness of where they are. The AV guys don't like to open those things in the water for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's sometimes the latch that keeps the door down is sketchy. And so the door might unhatch itself and come swinging back around. That's a heavy door. You could have injured people. You could lose fingers and stuff like that. The other reason is if there's a lot of spray, if that sea state is close to that three, you can take water in from the top. It won't be significant enough usually to cause any danger. But it messes up the inside of the vehicle, and they don't like that because the vehicle's radio is back there and some other things, and they just would rather not.
But especially with salt water, right, the corrosive effect of salt water and things like that. So they maintain the vehicle. So let me just everybody, if you update the diagram, if you draw a horizontal line behind the bottom two zeros – right, that would be kind of the compartment, and then just know this: the three guys that we've already identified, they're all hooked together with headsets, and they can talk on the intercom. So that's how the troop commander knows what's going on. And then if you draw a vertical line that just bisects the center of the troop compartment, that would represent the two hatches, and those things open up and out when they open. And so if you've seen pictures of Marines standing up in the back of it, normally ashore when they're moving, and you probably saw a bunch of those in the march up, it's these things get ashore, those overhead compartments open up, because riding around in the back of these things with those hatches closed is miserable. Right. Yeah. There's dependent on how the engine's doing that day. There's exhaust fumes in there a little bit. You're being thrown around in there. The air is disgusting because, people stink. Right. And they're Marines. Yeah. So they're farting. And I'll tell you what, some guys get seasick. And that's its own.
That's the guys throw up.
Oh my God, that's its own event, because as soon as one guy goes, another three more cut loose, And you're just sitting back there going, you got to be shitting me, man. How do I get me out of here as quick as I can? Now, so that's kind of the construct of the vehicle. I want to go back to the tactics real quick. Do these things go in onesies and twosies when they go, especially through the water, ship to shore? How do these things move?
Right. Well, the platoon is the AAV platoon. It's like anywhere, like I said, from 12 to 14. And sometimes those variants you talked about, Mac, are added for, you know, in case they're going to be needed. Like the communications variant, the command variant you talked about, and particularly that recovery variant is also added to the mix. So, but they're divided into three sections otherwise. And each section is three AAVs usually. And those three AAVs can carry about a platoon's worth of Marines. So each section would be another platoon, and when they go to shore, they'll usually either go in column, or they'll go on line because they're going to actually assault something on the beach, and that's you know related to use of their employment of their weapons and the Marines coming out of the AVs and actually assaulting on foot.
So
they don't travel alone, much like aircraft. There's a rule, a regulation that there's always a chase vehicle, i.e. another vehicle, particularly if there's a vehicle in distress when it has problems either with its radio or with its motor system, its way of motorizing itself around. If this thing's got issues, there'll be another vehicle with it to watch over it.
Got it. I got an email for you, Mac. First of all, great discussion on the AAV being an air winger. I have next to zero knowledge with them. Whenever I see them, I think about the slugfest in Anasaria during the march up, which is a lot of famous pictures and Amtrak's in most of those pictures. Another email from somebody who listens to the program. Who has a kid that's one of the officers on the Somerset.
Wow.
Yeah, saying that tough weekend. Godspeed to everybody. And then another one asking a question. Hey, Mac, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. I've heard F-18 Man come on and explain stuff. I've heard Joey Perrazzo come on and explain stuff. And it really helps those of us who are trying to understand this stuff and make sense of it. My question is, what kind of training on all these different systems do Marines do before they get on board? I know we have a helo dunker for guys going in aviation assets. What kind of land drills do these guys do so they get comfortable in the event of an emergency? In this case, not everybody got out, but some did. Right. Jeff, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, when I was a mech platoon commander, and then later on as a mech company commander, we drilled and drilled and drilled every chance we got with these guys to where there was cohesion between the AAV crewmen and the grunts, and particularly when it came to getting out of the AAV in order to attack or continue on with our missions. The other big thing we spent a lot of time on was getting out of the vehicle if there was an issue and in the water. And that's why I always want to have those top hatches to open as much as possible so that if necessary, we could get out. And there's life preservers and stuff that are in there, but I don't know how effective they'd be with all the PPE and stuff we were wearing.
The General Osterman made a comment in the press conference that the Marines they recovered were all wearing their PPE and a life preserver. He said so. Right. He said, look, I don't have, we haven't done an investigation, but it looks like the Marines were doing what they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
Explain, just so people know, explain the helo dunker. And because let me tell you, the safety component in all this is not an insignificant piece.
Yeah. Well, the helo dunker is
because we're amphibious, we're flying over water a lot. And sometimes the birds go down. We actually had a helicopter go down in the water in the Haditha Dam Lake.
Right.
Back in, I think it was 2006 or 7. And so it's an issue where the helo goes down and it rolls over in the water. And for those people who are in the water still alive, and a lot of times they are, it's confusing. What the helo dunker does, you go to it, and especially if you're going to be on a Mew, people who are going to be using helos habitually, what it does is you're actually get put through a situation like that in the water. And the idea is to find the escape and get out and not panic and, you know, and be able to get yourself out and away from the beleaguered helicopter so that you can be recovered alive. Okay. And so they do that.
Yeah. When my son Patrick was part of 3-5, they had an Osprey go in the water. And he was part of the helo company. So, and 23 of the 26 Marines got out, which I would, I think anybody, when you hear that, right, is would tell you that's a miracle. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
If you can imagine careening off a ship, and that's what this did, it was on the approach, and something happened relative to the aerodynamics and blasted the Osprey. It went into the water. And so you're going from getting ready to get out on board of the big deck. In that case, I can't remember what it was, but it might've been the Bonhomme Richard. And then all of a sudden you're upside down in the water. And that's what the helo dunker does, is it gives you repetitions in terms of don't panic, don't panic, don't panic. The other thing I learned from that was in the life vests themselves, there's an oxygen tank in that.
Yeah, you can.
And it has about, I think it has 5 minutes of oxygen in it. So it's in a pouch. And it's just one. It has this thing you stick in your mouth and you start breathing, designed to allow you to give you more time to egress the vehicle.
Make sure you close your nose though.
But again, 23 to 26 getting out. I mean, I certainly don't mean to sound callous about the three Marines that lost their lives, but I mean that's. Those are difficult times. I mean, difficult situations to be in, to think that 23 Marines got out. Talk to me about, so emergency egress out of a AAV, what's available to the guys in back?
Well, those top hatches, it's really the only way you can get out if you're in the water. The back hatch will not open until you're on shore. You know, the back hatch. And when it does, it comes down. Unless there's an emergency switch that's hit in the up by where the driver is, it will go down slow. It doesn't go open. It doesn't fall open like in the World War II movies. It goes slow, and I'm talking. It'll take about probably 10 seconds for the thing to open all the way. So the only way out really is through the top. Those two rectangular hatches on top. If there's a problem with the vehicle. And here's the thing. If there's a problem with the vehicle and you don't have the top hatches open, or you get one open, more water will come in that way if the vehicle's already sinking. So it's a dangerous vehicle. But it is highly seaworthy as far as, you know, between the ship to the shore to where, like I said, in 40-plus years, I've only seen, like, 3 incidents in actual operations where this – was an issue where it sunk.
And we use them all the time. I mean, they're constantly, constantly doing this. The
you know, I love the AAV. I could go on and on about the AAV because there's so much you could do with it. And when it was developed, Mac, it was developed as part of it was developed to be compatible with the M151, with the 105 towed, already the smallest piece of already we had. All that stuff, you know, was meant to be as a piece, an amphibious piece. It was compatible with the landing ship tank, the LST, the new one, right. The newest one, which we got rid of, you know, in the 90s. But, you know, a very, very practical use vehicle that, you know, if you knew it's a whole nother set of tactics to use those things effectively because they have drawbacks. And, you know, the whole key to tactics is trying to avoid your weaknesses and capitalize on your strengths. Right. So,
right. Which, and again, if you look at the Amtrak's performance in Iraq, I believe, if I recall, I only remember us losing one catastrophically, and that was up by by Haditha. All right, Jeff, one more question, and I'll let you go. And I certainly appreciate your time today. In terms of the way this thing survives, if it begins to take on water, it has bilge pumps, yes?
Yes.
And so those things are functioning. Those things they're electrical bilge pumps in the vehicle. And then there's manual bilge pumps in there as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I never saw them being used by us. We never had that issue. And I mean, we're talking two deployments as a lieutenant and then one as a captain. I'm talking hundreds of AAV missions, you know, and of those hundreds, dozens of them across the surf, you know, through the surf, and never did I ever have to do that. So yes, though, it does exist for sure.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else I haven't been smart enough to ask you about either Amtrak operations or anything else? You mentioned before we came on the air that one MEF in the Marine Corps released the names of the Marines that are presumed to be dead because the rescue portion of the mission is over, and now the recovery. The recovery part of the mission started over the weekend, so those names have been released. But is there anything else that I haven't been smart enough to ask you that you want to make sure people know? Okay, I can't. Hold on, I lost you again. Hold on, turn your speaker back on. I can hear you faintly. Nobody else can. All right, hold on one second. I will hang up on him, and we'll call him back, and then we'll let Jeff continue on his. Hello.
Hello.
All right, I can still barely hear you. So, is there any anything I haven't asked you that you want people to know?
I think we got it all, Mac.
Okay. All right, bud. Hey, I appreciate you coming on. And if we get any additional news, I'll yell and bring you back on this week. I don't know too many more guys who have more experience doing this than you do.
Appreciate it.
All right, bud. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Jeff Kenny here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Here's another email. Pretty cool to hear this discussion this morning. So many of us have so little experience in this area, even though we served in the Marine Corps. I knew when I turned this on this morning that you guys would be talking about it. And I also enjoy the respectful way that you guys discuss things and you don't speculate. Thoughts and prayers to all the families involved. God bless the Marines and their service. I listened to your podcast about the case to stand. I hope everybody that kneels knows that these Marines count too, and they should be respected. And I completely sympathize with your sentiment, Mac. Find a better way. That is the sentiment. That is the sentiment. Because every one of those Marines and their corpsmen will be buried under that American flag. So if you want to protest, find a better way to protest. But your ability to protest is guaranteed by selfless people, in this case, who've given the only life they'll ever have, whose families will bear the burden of that for their eternity. So yeah, they don't get to go back and do it again, or they don't get to go back and whatever. For them, their life is done. So anyway, Thanks for listening. The show a little bit shorter this week as we as I've got a bunch of stuff I have going on. So the shows will be about an hour or so. I appreciate Jeff Kenny's time for coming on this morning. So with that said, if you're just tuning in, we'll take a break, and then you'll hear the press conference that OneMef held on Friday. The Commandant of the Marine Corps was there. A good friend of mine, who's the commanding general of OneMef, which is the first Marine Expeditionary Force, which is all the Marines in Southern California, from the Ground Combat Element, the 1st Marine Division, to the 3rd Marine Air Wing down at Miramar, to the 1st Marine Logistics Group that's at Camp Pendleton as well. So General Osterman commands all of that. So he and General Berger speak at a press conference that you will hear in a few minutes. So more than anything else, tough week for the Marines and sailors involved. So keep them in your thoughts and prayers. Keep their families in your thoughts and prayers, but mostly for Marines and a sailor who gave their lives, and to their family, keep them in your thoughts and prayers. So on a Monday, we'll take a quick break. All Marine Radio, over and out.